All right. Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm Greg.
And I'm Ronak. So, Greg, why don't we start off with this one news topic? U.S. inflation slows in March. I think this could have a direct result on interest rates, which, you know, is going to have a huge impact on the startup ecosystem and how people perceive quote-unquote risky assets.
Love it. Let's talk about it.
Okay. So basically, the overall consumer price index increased 5% last month from a year ago, which is down 6% in February. So it still is above, you know, a good 5%, which is still high.
What is the historic inflation rate?
Yeah, so typically the U.S. tries to have inflation be around 2%, somewhere between 2 and 2.5%. So we are in a quote-unquote higher interest rate environment right now.
But they were actually thinking it would be 5.2, right? Was the consensus thinking. Yeah, so a little bit better than what people thought it would be.
Right. And if we zoom out a little bit, when we say that interest rates are high, they are in terms of the average historical rates. But if we rewind back to like the 1970s, we were actually seeing interest rates that were in the double digits and the high double digits, almost close to 20%+. So if somebody was trying to buy a house and get a mortgage, can you imagine paying 20% interest rate on your mortgage?
No, I cannot.
Right. Compared to just a couple years ago when people were able to get mortgages for around like 3%. I mean, this is a huge difference on the amount of capital that people can spend for other type of asset classes.
That's actually an interesting thing we can talk about. So listeners, once we sold our company, Lauren and I got into real estate investing. And we are buying another house right now that's going to be up in the Adirondacks. That's going to be primarily an Airbnb property. The interesting thing about right now is there are not a lot of people interested in buying homes, and there's really not a lot of inventory out there because of all this inflation and crazy interest rates, right? But it is an interesting time because we were able to actually negotiate that house down about $200,000. Which, when you think about it, okay, if I bought that for $1 million, you know, a year and a half ago at a lower interest rate, would I be paying the same amount that I would be paying right now with a higher interest rate, but a lower overall cost of a purchase price? It's about a wash for us once we did that calculation. And we actually got a relatively good interest rate based off of what we're seeing nationally. So, I'll just tell you what we got. We got 5.75%, which is honestly not too bad given that I'm seeing interest rates in like the 6.5 to 7 range primarily. So we got the house for cheaper. We're paying a relatively high interest rate, but not insane. But you know what we're going to do in a couple of years if interest rates come down? Refinance.
Right. So Greg, this actually brings up an interesting topic that investing in startups and angel investing is, you could sort of think about it as a single asset class. And you are an experienced real estate investor at this point too. So If you can imagine a world where I magically drop $10 million into your bank account and you could only invest in individual startup companies or real estate properties, how do you think you would divide up that $10 million between the two?
Interesting. I'd probably go 80% real estate, 20% startups.
So let's go through the pros and cons for each. What do you think is the first pro for real estate investing over startup investing?
Cash flow. So when I'm thinking about real estate investing, I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of how much monthly income can I bring in from these properties? Not necessarily like the future appreciation or the tax savings. It's really, am I thinking that this property is going to make more money than it costs to own it? So in the example of this house we're buying right now, our mortgage plus our insurance plus taxes will come out to around $5,500 a month for this property. in terms of how much we can make from it a month, it'll probably be in the 15 to 20,000 a month. So you're having a nice cash flow monthly coming from that. I mean, that doesn't include like internet, cleaning and all that kind of stuff. But overall, we'd be looking to make at least 10K on that property monthly with the hope of hitting over 100K for the year in profit. That's one big pro for real estate for me.
So I do think that there's one big con that comes to mind. So I mean, making $10,000 a month, that sounds fantastic, but how much work goes into it on an ongoing basis?
For us personally, not as much as you'd think.
Ooh, tell me more.
So when we started all this, we recruited somebody, a good friend of ours, that was looking to leave their profession and do something else. She was interested in interior decorating, and I recruited her to become our property manager for the one property we have in the Catskills, and then as we expand out. So we hired her through our LLC, which is really a real estate LLC that owns the properties, and we can talk about that in a future episode, how you kind of set those up. But we pay her a salary, plus basically a bonus on whatever gross bookings happen during the year. But for us, for Lauren and I, it's a very passive investment. We don't do that much. She does all the communication. She does the back and forth with the cleaners, the contractors. For us, it's really quite minimal. I think we work on it probably when we're not adding a new house, maybe an hour a week.
Maybe an hour a week. Okay. So that is quite minimal. And to be getting roughly $10,000 a month off of an hour's worth of work per week, given the initial capital, yeah, that does sound pretty great. Any other cons that you can think of for real estate investing?
It takes a fair amount of capital up front to get those up and running. Yep. So when you're thinking about it, like the way we did one of the properties, we used our brokerage account. We took out a security-backed line of credit to pay for that house like outright. I would do that differently now. But now we're doing more of the traditional, hey, we're going to go out and get a mortgage, which is why we have the interest rate. But you still have to put a down payment down. Like I think we're putting 25 or 30% down just to buy the points to get the lower interest rate. But it does take a significant amount of capital up front to get that up and running. But again, like if depending on how much you're putting in, if you could make that back in a year, that's pretty damn good. Mm-hmm.
So Greg, if somebody is renting out one of your properties and like a pipe breaks and there's some big issue, do you get involved or will the property manager take care of everything and you don't even have to stress about it?
Yeah, primarily it's going to be the property manager. I mean, we'll hear about it, but for the most part now she takes care of really everything. So calling the plumber, getting all that, getting quotes for fixing whatever the issue is, choosing who she's going to contract with. It's a pretty minimal amount of effort for us, which is exactly what we wanted.
Right, right. That makes sense. So you said 20% over to the startup world and angel investing. What do you see as the biggest pro with investing in startups as opposed to real estate?
Oh, it's going to be the upside, right? So with startup investing, it's an illiquid investment, similar to real estate. It's not that liquid, right? You have to go through the process of selling a house before you can actually liquidate. But for a startup, you're looking for, I guess, the appreciation, basically, the equivalent of appreciation on a house, but you're looking for it in like mega appreciation, right? So you're looking for that investment to go from worth, you know, maybe it's worth $100,000 if you put $100,000 in to go to $1 million. Like I'm not going to see a house likely 10x in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. 70% would be amazing. 50% would be amazing over the price that we bought it for. But if you can get a 10x on an investment into a startup, that's when you're starting to look pretty good. And honestly, I think about it. So if we had $10 million to invest between real estate and startups, and I put $2 million into startups and we could 5X that, you're basically getting that entire amount back that you originally had. So you're making maybe $10 million off those investments. That would be pretty nice.
Interesting. I actually think I would go a different route. I think I would probably do something around 10% in real estate and probably 90% into startups, given a $10 million bank account where those were the only two options that I have. My thinking here is that real estate does give you some nice cash flow, which is great. I'm trying to live a relatively humble lifestyle. I think the t-shirt that I'm wearing cost me $6 on Amazon. I was talking to my girlfriend last night, and she was, you know, making a couple comments about my wardrobe and how I have like, you know, 8 different versions of the same black t-shirt. And, you know, I gave her my cell phone that was on Amazon. I told her to feel free to pick another color. And she was really excited to do that. And I was thinking to myself, this is kind of awesome. All I have to do is like pick a different color and my girlfriend's happy. I don't have to upgrade from a $6 shirt to a $600 Louis Vuitton shirt. I'm trying to live a life where I don't need too much cash flow to live. Relatively humble, relatively simple. Instead, with the startup world, what I think that gives you is an opportunity to have outsized impact on what the future looks like. You're basically investing in companies that you believe in that are trying to push the world and actually do something productive with, you know, should we be focusing on climate change? Should we be focusing on this problem or that problem? Whatever it is, I like the idea of helping the world. And I think you get a little bit more of that with the startup side of it than the real estate side. And then layer on top of it the potential to outperform. You know, you could theoretically take that $9 million that's invested in the startup side of things and get 100x return on your money. All of a sudden, I'm getting close to being a billionaire. I know I just mentioned a $6 t-shirt, but being a billionaire doesn't sound so bad.
I think for us, it's also, we got really interested in the real estate game, mostly because it is something that you can kind of hack, right? Like you can de-risk real estate quite easily when you start to learn a market. For us, we mostly invest within the New York State real estate market because you have Manhattan, you have the metropolitan area of Manhattan, which has, I don't know, 35 million people that live within a 100-mile radius of it. And for us, it's an easy way to know kind of what cash flow is going to come through and for us to never really have to think about making money any other way. That's for Lauren and I, that's kind of the interesting piece is like, can we replace salaries from just the real estate investing?
Right. And to be fair, you also have 2 kids. I don't have multiple mouths to feed.
And there's also amazing tax breaks and things that you can take advantage of within real estate that you can't really do with startups. That's the other piece is like, you know, if you've never heard of cost segregation studies and bonus depreciation and you own real estate, you should look into it.
On that topic, we should also at some point talk about taxes for startups. But yeah, let's not turn this this podcast into a real estate podcast. It is an interesting topic though. One thing you did mention about real estate though is that there's a large upfront cost. There are REITs out there, real estate investment trusts, where theoretically you can invest just like in any kind of publicly traded stock, just like, you know, $100, $200 and get exposure to the real estate world. I don't think that...
I'm curious how those work, to be honest, because...
Yeah.
I would not want to be within that category if they're exposed to commercial real estate right now.
So there's many different type of REITs, ones that specialize in different type of real estate property. So everything from like office buildings to owning the land underneath a data center, you know, a whole bunch of different things. And the way that they work is, you know, just like any other real estate property, they rent it out, they collect rent, and then they by law are required to distribute 90% of their income that they generate, of the profits that they generate. So that way they qualify as a special real estate trust.
Are there any short-term rental REITs?
I don't know if any short-term rental REITs. Actually, all of the ones that I'm aware of are extremely long-term, where they'll sign like a 30-year lease with a Walgreens or something like that. Let's touch on a couple other asset classes real quick. Do you have any interest in gold?
No, not really.
Yeah, it's that unproductive asset. It looks nice. It's kind of shiny, but not too interested in it. Are you interested in bonds?
I probably should be, but I don't have exposure to it at all.
Okay. I have a little bit, I would say maybe like 1-2% of my portfolio in just US treasuries. Stable income, not going anywhere, tax efficient, but also probably the most boring investment you could probably ever make.
Should we talk about the one I made recently?
What's the one you made recently?
JEPI.
JEPI. Let's talk JEPI. So for those of you that aren't aware, JEPI is an ETF, a covered call ETF that's put out by JP Morgan that's actively managed. So
this podcast is not investment advice, folks. This is what I'm doing. You do not need to follow. Please do not follow what I'm doing.
Right, right. So let's talk about what their strategy is real quick. So what this managed fund does is they will go and buy stock in some of the biggest companies out there that largely mimic the S&P 500. So think about companies like Pepsi and Johnson & Johnson and all of these large companies. And then what they'll do is they'll write call options on top of that. So basically, they'll own the underlying shares, let's say Pepsi. They'll own, let's say, one share of Pepsi, and then they'll have a contract that says that if Pepsi stock goes up in the next month, then they will sell the shares. And if it stays lower than that, then they'll keep the shares. And in order to write that contract, they collect a premium. And as they do this with more and more stocks in their portfolio, they pay out that premium to the investors of these funds. So it's sort of a play on the volatility of the stock market, more so than the underlying stocks themselves. So basically, the more stable and non-volatile the market is, the better the strategy will probably do. So Greg, do you have an idea of like how much of a yield you're getting from JEPI?
Yeah, let me check right now. I think it was 11.75% last time that I checked. So much higher than a lot of the savings accounts that you're seeing that are doing 3.5, 4.0, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I chose it was one of the other goals that I have is for my brokerage account to create passive income for our family as well, not just the houses that we're owning. So JEPI is an interesting investment from that angle. Although I think it's taxed at ordinary income, at least for the distributions, right, but maybe not the dividends. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's both within it.
Yeah, I think it's something like 80% is taxed as regular income and 20% as qualified capital gains. It's interesting how you and I are taking completely different strategies. I'm actually actively trying to lower my income as much as possible. My favorite large company out there is Berkshire Hathaway that pays no income, no dividend. And you're more interested in the cash flow and earning income through real estate, JEPI, different things like that.
For sure. Yeah. I have kids. They're expensive.
Right. Right. I can have ramen noodles every night. Yeah. Fair enough.
We'll see if the long-term strategy of having JEPI makes sense. It's a relatively new ETF, right? It's what, 2 years old, 3 years old, something like that?
That's right. Yeah.
So again, this is not financial advice.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. So Greg, okay, let's get back to the topic at hand. We're a podcast about angel investing in startups. And on this episode, it sounds like income is really important to you. So an interesting combination between the startup world and the income world is venture debt. Is this something that you've ever paid attention to, looked at more closely, completely ignored?
I've always completely ignored it. Never even thought about taking venture debt when I was a startup and, you know, managing a startup. No, never thought about it.
Okay, so what is venture debt? Venture debt is basically, as an investor, you're giving a loan to a startup. So let's say you're giving them $100,000 and they are going to pay you back, let's say 5% interest over the next 3 years for that loan. And what you could do is negotiate in a way where you also get some equity upside. So let's say, again, you loan the company $100,000, they give you 5% interest, but then as a thank you for essentially making that loan, they'll also give you, let's say, 1% of the company, right? So it's not a traditional loan where the only thing that you care about is interest, but you're also getting upside in the company. So it actually is really interesting that since the company is giving away equity and raising money, but there is no priced round, right? That equity is still based at the same valuation as the previous round. So a lot of times when a company is in between rounds and just need a little bit of additional capital sort of as a bridge until their next big round, they'll go through a process like this so that way they don't have to do that large complicated money raise and renegotiate what the value of the company is in between multiple rounds. So I do think that there is a place for venture debt, both in people's portfolios, as well as it does make sense for some startups to take on. But I would say that it is a little bit more worrisome when a company is taking on venture debt, right? Like something probably has been going wrong where they just did not plan out what their burn is, when they were going to raise, and just like all these things just did not come together in an elegant fashion. And they're just looking for a band-aid solution to just get to that next point where they can calm everything down again. So by taking on that little bit extra risk, you are getting a little bit extra reward with that interest. But when you're investing in startups, it's already a little bit risky. And this just always to me has felt like risky squared. So I've tried to avoid venture debt, but I understand that it's out there. And if you can get a good deal, you can get a good deal. But I feel much more comfortable with just straight equity, understanding the valuation and moving on.
See, I think there's something a little more interesting that I would have taken as a founder. Actually, we did take as a founder, is the ability to raise capital from companies that basically buy your future revenue, right? So something like Pype. So Pype does the exact same thing as venture debt, basically, but they're looking at your forward-facing ARR and are giving you money that then you basically pay back using that forward ARR. So instead of having to go raise capital and giving away equity, what you could do is basically give away future revenue to then fund your operations into the future. So that's something that we did, but not through Pype. We actually did it through Stripe. So Stripe has Stripe Capital, where they're actually looking and saying, okay, you guys are growing, you know, X percent month over month. You guys are bringing in this revenue. We're going to offer you a loan, you know, 25,000, 50,000, 100,000, depending on how much you're bringing in. And then every transaction that comes through Stripe, they're taking a portion of that until you pay that loan back. So instead of giving away equity on top of it, you're just basically taking a loan out from the payment processor when if you're going through Stripe, or same thing with Pype. So I don't know why you would really go into the venture debt world if you have to do both equity and a percent.
I think it's important to remember not every company has that opportunity.
I guess if you have revenue, you should have that opportunity.
You mean already established revenue going on. But if a company is in a purely growth mode and not taking on any revenue.
Yeah, if you have no revenue, then you're screwed from that standpoint.
Yeah, right.
But again, if you're taking on additional capital and you have no revenue and you're in growth mode, I don't know what you're growing towards if you're not making revenue.
Right.
Especially in this environment. Like, I don't know who's going to fund you then.
Right. That's fair.
It's no longer 2021.
I'm working on the time machine. Give me another couple months.
Dude, that'd be awesome. I would love a time machine. Yeah. Would you go into the future or the past?
I would go into the future. I'm more curious about where the human race is going.
What if you go too far?
What's too far?
The world's gone.
If there was a dinosaur that wanted to go into the future and there's no more dinosaurs, but there's a bunch of people, same thing. Like
maybe there'll be dinosaurs instead.
Whoa. Yeah. Now we're talking.
Jurassic World.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to stay in the show.
Right. I was actually reading the book Jurassic Park maybe about a year ago. I thought it was really interesting that the entire book is kind of centered around a startup that's looking for venture capital funding and going through all. Yeah. Like the company, set up this entire theme park, and it really is just a biotech business.
Oh, it is a Michael Crichton book. I thought so. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And like all the different cities and locations that they mention in that book are like Mountain View and Palo Alto, all places I used to live back in the Bay Area, which was kind of cool.
That's crazy. I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. Because in the movie, it's not portrayed that way.
Yeah, not at all. Very, very different, the book and the movie.
Sounds like the book might be more fun. Mm-hmm. All right, what else do we got? You want to talk about how Tiger is getting out of growth stage capital? Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't see that. No, what's happening there?
So basically they are selling their stocks that they own in secondary and saying basically we're done. They're getting out of that basically asset category is what I heard.
I think this is where lessons from Warren Buffett come in. When others are fearful, be greedy. When others are greedy, be fearful. Tiger Global is getting out of the startup game. That sounds really interesting to me to double down on that area.
Yeah, let's see if I can find a good article. Yeah, so there's an article in Business Today India saying that both SoftBank's Vision Fund, which is, I think, the largest VC mm-hmm. fund in the world, and Tiger Global Management have dropped out of the top 20 list in the first quarter of the year, according to Crunchbase. Both firms are, quote unquote, taking a breather. They continue to scale down investments across markets. Meanwhile, Andreessen Horowitz and General Catalyst emerged as the most active and speediest lead investors in the first quarter, Q1 2023. Intriguing. So I can't find a good article about them actually fully exiting early stage venture or growth stage venture, but we'll see if I can find something, put it into the show notes.
I mean, a big player like that coming out of the market just adds more opportunities for other people to come in.
Yeah. Tiger Global tried to sell VC fund stakes and latest sign of strategy shift. Yeah. So it looks like they're backing out, which is interesting because they were super active. So for physicians out there, Tiger Global was it's basically a hedge fund, right? Like, are they do public stocks, private stock, or private investments, but they came down from super late stage companies to early stage companies. And Tiger Global was known as the VC firm that would write you a gigantic check at a really, really high valuation and then leave you alone. That was it. They would literally just write you checks and then you're off on your own, which a lot of founders liked. But the problem is that they're the ones that they are one of the players that really drew up the competition, which is how valuations got out of hand and just insane valuations happened in 2021 and some of 2022. But now they're basically saying, we're out, we're getting out, which is interesting. So that's another little quick topic we can talk about too. We can talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia. And so on Twist, on This Week in Startups, they mentioned that Andreessen Horowitz, which is one of the gigantic players in venture capital based in Silicon Valley, they were doing a presentation in Saudi Arabia with the one and only Adam Neumann on stage talking about taking LP money from Saudi Arabia, which is an interesting topic that we can go to, mostly because there's a lot of... I don't know how to say this.
There's just like moral implications.
Yes.
Right? That like when a company is starting up and building itself, right? It needs a certain level of capital, but the capital that they're taking on is not all the same, right? It's kind of like when you're an investor, you want to get a return on your investment, but it's kind of different when you're investing in an electrical EV company versus a cigarette manufacturer, especially for our audience as physicians, right? That like, is investing in a cigarette company really doing so much great for the world? At the very least, it's debatable, right? So same thing with the other way around. When a company is raising money, well, where did that money come from? Is it blood money in some ways, or is it coming from a source that made their money in a very ethical and nice way?
And so the reason that we're talking about this is because, you know, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East has a lot of capital that they're looking to deploy that is kind of just sitting there a little bit on the sidelines. Like this Saudi PIF, which is a public investment fund, which is a sovereign fund, has $620 billion.
Say that number again.
$620 billion.
That can fund a lot of startups.
That can fund a lot of venture firms.
Wow.
Okay. So according to Global Newswire Research and Markets, it looks like the global venture capital investment market size had reached $233.9 billion in 2022, which means that basically that PIF fund has almost 3x the entire investment market at least a year ago, which is absolutely insane when you think about it. Basically, Saudi Arabia could be the entire venture funding market for years.
That's interesting.
So the question is, as a founder or as a venture fund, are you comfortable taking that money? And we can also throw in another interesting story, an interesting topic that came about over the last year, LIV Golf. If you're a golf fan, you've probably heard of LIV Golf now. And the fact that they're taking players from the PGA by offering them guaranteed salaries of really a lot of money. So you have Phil Mickelson over there. You have Brooks Koepka, who almost won the Masters. Cam Smith. A lot of really big names went over because it's guaranteed money. But they also had to answer a lot of questions on, are you comfortable taking Saudi money? It's the same thing with venture capital. It's the same thing with if you're running a venture fund. Do you go take that money? Do you not take that money? You know, it's kind of an interesting moral question that you have to ask yourself. And then as a startup founder, do you want to know where that money came from that you're accepting? So, you know, if you're going to an Andreessen Horowitz, who's, you know, taking money from Saudi Arabia, do you want to know that? And are you okay with that? Or do you want to go find another VC firm that's not taking money from them? And the other caveat being the LP market in the US right now is very, very dry. Not a lot of people are writing checks, you know. So when, let's actually break down, what does that actually mean? So when a venture fund is looking to raise capital, who do they go to? They go to their limited partners, who are typically, you have family offices. So if a family, you know, the Walmart family, I don't know if they have a family office, but that's kind of the thing that you think about is like the Walmart family, that would be a family office type of style investment that could become an LP in a venture fund. And then you also think about institutional LPs, meaning endowments. So Harvard's endowment, you can think of pension funds. So the Pennsylvania Iron Workers Pension Fund, you know, a lot of these pensions, these endowments, family offices are exposed to venture capital again, because you can potentially get outlier returns from it. So there's not many people in the US within that LP network that are actively writing checks into venture funds right now because of the way the market is reacting to everything, because the IPO window is frankly shut right now. And they're kind of waiting on the sidelines to see what happens with interest rate, what happens with, you know, does the IPO window open back up? Does M&A activity start up again? Because for the past 2 years, you know, they're exposed to venture funds that are exposed to startups with very, very high valuations that a lot of these companies are having growing pains trying to grow into, because they took, you know, 50 times, 100 times their revenue. They're going to have these down rounds, which means that venture funds should be marking down those investments, which means VCs aren't looking like they're going to return very much in this last vintage. And so these LPs are saying, maybe we can go out and get into a different asset category that might perform better over the next 5 years, is my guess.
This is so foolish to me. We all know that you want to buy low and sell high, not buy high and sell low. And Greg, I think you're exactly right that the venture capital vintages from like 2021 probably aren't going to be all that great. But that's probably where you saw a ton of venture capital money flowing from these LPs. On the other hand, the vintages from 2023, this is just my guess. I can't predict the future, but my guess is that the vintages from 2023 are going to perform quite well. And this is exactly when people are not stepping up to the plate.
It'll probably look like 2008 to 2010, where you had a lot of amazing companies being built. And the nice thing is, like, when you're now in a more normal environment for funding, we've talked about this, right? The stepwise function of venture capital. You get a pre-seed investment, you hit metrics, you get a seed investment, you hit metrics, you get a series A, series B. Those things are possible when you're raising at appropriate valuations. If you go out and raise a seed round at a $50 million valuation and you have no revenue, when you try to go and raise that A, you better have $5 million in revenue, or else you're probably going to have a down round. So these companies, though, are growing, I think, in the appropriate way, where they're growing into valuations and hopefully will be able to have up rounds going forward, and will hopefully build a solid base of efficient revenue production and not just growing to grow, but become a profitable business earlier on.
Right. So if you look at Amazon's stock real quick, back in the year 1999, they got to a peak of around, on a split adjusted basis, around $5.50. And then just a couple years later, after the dot-com bubble burst, their stock fell to around $0.28. So $5.50 to 28 cents. And fast forward to today, and yes, everything did incredibly well with Amazon, but your return could have been an extra 20x more had you waited until 2001, where everybody was scared of the tech world, versus investing in 1999, where everybody was piling in. So again, these LPs that got in the VC vintage of 2021, I mean, maybe they'll still do fine, but I have a
maybe
hard time
they will make 1x.
Right. I have a hard time believing that they're going to do anywhere near as well as the vintage of 2023.
Yeah. And I think there's a variety of different reasons too, when you think about it, right? So you have companies that are focused on building products that are also going to make money, which are hopefully going to be profitable. They're raising at the right valuations, hopefully. And then you also have just a ton of talent coming into the system too, when you think about it, from all of these massive layoffs from gigantic tech companies, from Amazon to Facebook to Google. All of them have let go of, you know, folks from engineering to sales, which means you have a fair amount of talent potentially that can come together and create really interesting companies, not to mention the fact that you have like a phase shift in the entire technology stack with AI, which we haven't even touched on. I mean, the companies that you can now build were impossible to build 3 years ago. Impossible. Like, even from the standpoint of needing to hire AI engineers, ML engineers, NLP engineers, you can use ChatGPT and these other products to basically have an entire engineering team that's focused entirely on artificial intelligence and all the things around it, which did not exist 3 years ago, at least in the way that it exists now.
So are you getting closer and closer to flipping your $10 million portfolio to 20% real estate and 80% startups?
No.
Fair enough.
Hey, $2 million to put into startups is a fair amount of money for one person. So yeah, we'll see what we do over the next 10 years. That's the thing. These timelines are extremely long, right? For these investments. It's not like you're going to find out in a month or two. It's like, right, you won't find out for 5 to 7 to 10 years or more. I think that's good. You want to talk about anything else?
No.
Yeah. Well, thanks for tuning in to the Physician Syndicate podcast. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.